It's weird. I just kind of put the book out this year, and I didn't plan it around anything. But of course, with the Maiden Tour happening, there's been a lot of Maiden events going on.
Right.
I went to Croatia for the first show on the tour, and there's a lot of events there. So I did a Q&A and promoted the book, sold a load of books there. And then these guys were having their Beast Feast, they called it.
Yeah.
I came along for that and sold some more books. And so it's worked out really well, you know.
Yeah. How was the event? Well, we briefly talked about, so it was pretty nice.
Yeah, it was great. It was really good. You know, Dennis Stratton from the first Iron Maiden album was there, and Loopy Newhouse. Do you know who he is?
Which one?
Loopy Newhouse, Steve.
No.
he was one of Iron Maiden's early crew.
Right.
So he saw like their early years, and he wrote a book called Loopy World.
Uh-huh.
And it's great because it's really an inside view of early Iron Maiden going on tour in a little van and stuff like that around the UK, which is when they were playing pubs and clubs.
Right.
And what I like about it is it's just like it's complete honesty. There's no... He's not trying to push any angle or anything. It's just funny stories of them on the road. And he'll say when things aren't good. And, and the trouble is with official biographies and official videos, you know, that you always get, oh, the band was great. And then they got even greater. And then they got really great. And in Loopy World, he shows you that actually it wasn't all brilliant all the time.
All right.
You know?
Okay. So did he has a book also out?
Yeah. And his one's been translated into Finnish recently.
All right.
Which I haven't done yet, but so yeah, his Loopy World is out in Finnish. I can't remember what the Finnish title of it is, but confused me anyway.
Right, but now your book is basically out. Where people can order? Can they order it from somewhere?
Yeah, it's on Amazon. It's print to order.
Okay.
I mean, I was looking at publishing companies and stuff like that. I've done other books before on different topics. And the trouble with publishing companies is, well, there's several problems. First of all, they take the money.
Right.
And secondly, they decide how it comes out and where it goes and that. Amazon print to order, you can order it from anywhere, you know. And print to order as well means it gets printed in, like, a country nearby. So I don't think they do print to order directly in Finland, but you can order from Amazon.de.
Yes.
And it'll get printed in Germany and sent. And if somebody orders it in America, it'll get printed in America and sent to them.
Uh-huh, okay.
And if you order it in Britain, it gets printed in Britain, which means that, you know, we're avoiding, you know, posting things across the world. It means that we're avoiding any import-export tax. You know, Brexit now, we've introduced taxes to stop us trading with the outside world. And that avoids all that by getting it directly from your local Amazon. So, yeah, if anyone, you know, is interested, it's go to your local Amazon, type in Inside the Skunk Works Machine in the books section.
So is it basically at the Amazon.de, German Amazon, is it in the listing there?
Yeah.
Because I guess that's the most convenient place in Finland, for example.
That's what I was thinking. It's probably closest for here.
Yeah.
Amazon, it's great in some ways. I mean, obviously Amazon's got problems in some aspects of the company that we don't like, but because it is universal and it's around the world, it means people can get the book anywhere, really.
Yes.
It's too convenient. And it also means it won't get sold out, because obviously a normal book, they press up 2,000 copies, and when that's sold, the publisher will think, is it worth printing up another 2,000? Maybe not. And that's why so many books are out of print.
Mm.
Print to order, there is no stock of this book anywhere.
Uh-huh. Okay.
There are no copies in Amazon warehouses. It's just literally, if you buy it, they will print it for you and send it to you.
Okay. So it's always basically based on the incoming orders. They print it. So is it an Amazon service, that whole thing, the printing of it?
Yeah. Okay. And that's it. Amazon print it and Amazon post it. Which means I was quite happy to write the book, but I didn't really want to be the guy going to the post office every day with tons of packages.
Yeah, true.
And also dealing with, you know, complaints if it turned up a bit damaged or something. This isn't my fault. It's Amazon. Just go to them. And Amazon, of course, they're good at customer service. If it turns up damaged, just order another one and they send you another one. Yeah.
Okay. That sounds pretty convenient.
Yeah. It's convenient is the thing. Yeah.
So you are basically the sole publisher or
Yeah, totally. Yeah, yeah. And that's it. Yeah, I own the book. I own the rights to it.
Yeah.
I don't have to share that with the publishing company.
Yeah.
And if, you know, if a, like happened with Loopy's book, if somebody wants to translate it into Finnish and release it here, then I've got the rights to license it out to publishing companies. Okay. And Amazon don't have a problem with me doing that. And they also don't have a problem with me like ordering in bulk and then selling like at the gig last night.
Okay.
So it's convenient, it really is. Yeah,
sounds good.
Yeah.
But kind of like a self-publishing platform.
It is self-publishing, yeah, basically. And also, I mean, even just like on the tiniest scale.
Yeah.
Because all you do is you write a book in a Word document, convert it to PDF and upload it to the Amazon website, and then it's live and anyone can order it.
Right.
So like, you know, literally with your drums or studio or something, if you want to do, here's a guide to my studio and take some photos and write a little bit about the equipment that you use, you can publish that as a book.
Yeah.
And right. Someone might buy it and they might not.
Yeah.
Or even like family photos.
Yeah.
Here's the photos from my holiday. And just, it's a book as soon as you upload it to Amazon.
Yeah. So is it basically also the layout and everything? That's, I guess, you need to basically create first.
Yeah.
And then based on that, they then print it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Thing. So they don't change anything in it.
Right.
I did all the layout for that. I put the photos in and chose exactly where they wanted to be and exactly the spacing for everything. So all the mistakes are mine. Yeah. And they don't change any of it as you upload it. And they do check it. They spend like 24, 48 hours just checking the book is in the right format and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
I did get a guy to do the cover artwork, a guy called Chris Knappman, who's really good with artwork. That's not my specialist subject.
Yeah.
I got a guy to proofread it for me to check that I didn't spell everything wrong. But apart from that, I put the whole thing together.
That's very nice.
Yeah.
It looks like a big bunch of information.
Well, that's it. It's because I thought, I'm only going to do this book once. There's not going to be like a volume two with stories that aren't quite as good and some of the out of focus photos. I'm going to put all the cool photos and all the stories in one book. Right. And it's ended up as like 375 pages.
Yeah.
But I think it's a good book, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm a music fan, you know, as we were talking in the car. And I was thinking, what would I want to see in a book? And I want to hear all the funny stories backstage, but I also want to hear how they recorded the album and what the techniques that were going on and the producer's input. And Jack Endino, the producer, had an input into the book, and so did our drummer, Alex Elena, and loads of fans coming in with their views and fans reviewing gigs. And there's people saying, oh, I was at Tavastia in 94. And I'd write to them and go, okay, write me a quick review of it.
Yeah.
And so we've got fan reviews through the book and then people sending in scans of their ticket stubs and posters, and I've got all my backstage passes scanned in there.
Right.
And we've obviously got the full Sarajevo story.
Yeah.
And just absolutely everything. So it's ended up as quite a big book, but that's what I think people want.
Yeah, I think especially like if you are, for example, me, when I was reading the Bruce's autobiography book, I'm more interested in the exactly like, you know, the Bruce's solo career. Of course, I'm a little bit interested in the Iron Maiden stuff as well, but I'm particularly interested how, for example, these certain albums may have weighed things we are talking likely today here as well. So
absolutely.
So that's basically, that's the way
to go. It's all there, you know.
Yeah. Did it have any like a starting fee or something? Or is there?
No, it's like, literally upload it and go.
Okay.
And then royalties come in.
Right.
There is no, and that's the other thing with publishing companies. They sometimes give you an advance for the book, and then when the book starts making profit, then you can get a royalty. And this is just royalties from day one. So if you write a book and you only sell one copy, you still get royalties for that one copy. Yeah. It's crazy. It's just like such an easy and convenient system.
Sounds really good.
Yeah. Cool. I just have had a problem with publishing companies and also record companies in general, you know, from my experiences in several bands over the years where, I mean, Bruce's Skunk Works album has been re-released a couple of times and, you know, they came out with a double vinyl recently and stuff like that.
Right.
That's all great. But other bands I've been in, once your album has sold a fair few, it's no longer available.
Yeah.
And the only way people can get that album then is secondhand on eBay for twice the price, you know?
Yeah.
And that doesn't happen with this. It's always there.
Yeah. Yeah, looking forward to diving into that one.
Yeah, yeah. I think you'll find a lot in there.
Yeah, I believe so. So basically, when Balls to Picasso, the album, Bruce solo album, Balls to Picasso, when it was recorded, by the Tribe of Gypsies people. But then you guys then with the Skunk Works ended up touring with it. How did that end up to be in that way?
Well, so Bruce recorded Balls to Picasso in Los Angeles with Roy Z and his Tribe of Gypsies, as you say. Tribe of Gypsies at the time had just got themselves a record deal. And so they obviously wanted to go and promote their own band.
All right.
Rather than go on tour with Bruce.
Okay.
Bruce needed to tour, so he needed a touring band. And he got Alex Dixon, who's amazing guitarist, amazing musician, songwriter all around. And he lived around the corner from Bruce, and they knew each other anyway. Alex's old band Gun had opened for Maiden a couple of times, and so they knew each other. So that was an instant, we'd get him in. And then Bruce said in a Kerrang interview that he was looking for a bass player and drummer. And I saw that. I was like, right, I was working with a great drummer at the time, Alex Elena. And so we just had our little demo tape. It was, back for now, obviously, you'd send him a YouTube link. But back then it was a little cassette and we put it in the post.
Yeah,
a photo, the proper old school way, and a CV with a name and address and telephone number. And sent it off to Sanctuary Management. And we heard back a couple of weeks later. And they said, come on in for a meeting. And so we were called into a meeting with Rod Smallwood. And that was kind of like in at the deep end straight away. Because obviously, oh my God, it's Rod Smallwood. Shit. It's kind of daunting, And we went into this boardroom meeting with him. And he was absolutely lovely. And he explained how the project was going to go. And that they wanted to do a whole load of touring for this new album. And me and my drummer mate Alex were like, wow, this sounds great. Yeah, I love it. And we got called in for an audition then. They gave us the Balls to Picasso album on cassette. It hadn't been released at the time.
Okay.
So it was our first time hearing it. Actually, he put it on in the Sanctuary boardroom and he just put it on stupidly loud on these big speakers and then left the room, and me and the drummer just sat there, this Cyclops blaring at us. Yeah. And let's turn it down a little bit and have a proper listen. And then we took the cassette home. They told us to learn four songs. So we just learned the whole album because we thought that's probably the best thing to do. And we went into a rehearsal studio, a small rehearsal studio in West London with Bruce Dickinson. And that was quite funny, the first time meeting him there. And he just seemed like a perfectly normal guy. He's just the singer in the band. I remember he helped me carry my bass amp into the studio.
Oh, fair.
I had these big Ampeg cabs and I was struggling to get it through the doorway. And he was like, oh, let me give you a hand there. I was just thinking, I didn't think rock star lead singers generally helped carry Ampeg cabs. I think that might have been the only time he tried, but he learned his lesson. They're pretty heavy. But the fact that he was doing things like that, and he was just totally relaxed and normal guy and enthusiastic, and we told him we'd learned the whole album. He was like, oh, great, let's try this one, And we just ran through a bunch of the songs with him and Alex Dixon. That was the first time we met them both.
All right.
And at the end of it, he was getting really casual. Just like, let's go for a drink. So we just went out for a drink, and he chatted about, what his plans were, and again, all seemed casual. Then he dropped me off home and called up a couple of weeks later saying, can you learn some cover versions? Because he wanted us to be able to jam around a little bit. So we did some Deep Purple and some AC/DC with him and stuff. And I remember being in the studio that second time, just like playing AC/DC Sin City with Bruce Dickinson singing. I'm thinking, when I was a kid, some of the first records I owned were AC/DC and Iron Maiden, and here I am in a studio playing AC/DC with a singer of Iron Maiden. And I just thought, even if I don't get the job, even if it doesn't happen, that's just the funniest thing ever to have done, And it was just all like that from the start, just nice and relaxed. And then he said at the end of the second audition, yeah, you've got the job, that's cool.
All right.
What he actually said was, he said, so I'm happy being in a band with you guys if you're happy being in a band with me.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah, I think we're quite happy being in a band with Bruce Dickinson. You know? he's a pretty good singer.
Right.
He's passed our audition, I think.
Yeah. Like him.
So then we were just, then we got given the tour dates and we were off to America and it all went crazy for a while.
Yeah. So did you happen to basically living in the same area?
Yeah, that was another thing he was quite keen on. He was living in West London, and he wanted people based in West London, basically. Right. And I think some of the other people that had maybe applied for the job were living in the north of England and stuff. And nothing against that, but what he wanted was someone that could be around all the time, because it was a full-time band. And so if you had someone who lived a few hours away, then it would be problematic with, you know, we've got a rehearsal next week. Can you drive down? We'll get you a hotel. He didn't want all that. He just wants, right, come down to the studio tomorrow. Let's go for a beer tonight.
Yeah.
And also then we're flying from the same airport together and it's all nice and convenient. And I was in West London. I was in Hounslow. He was in Chiswick. Alex Dixon was also in Chiswick. And we're all within a couple of miles of each other, you know. So that was... Yeah, that was one of the things he wanted. He wanted it to be kind of a friendly band, you right? Know?
Yeah, a little bit of change, I guess. Well, from at least from Iron Maiden way of working, possible.
Well, it's true. I mean, I suppose Iron Maiden in their early days, they would all have been East London.
Yeah.
But then obviously gradually as they make money and start buying properties abroad, and well, if you've got the chance to live in Florida, why not, you know?
Yeah.
So I guess with Maiden these days, it must be like that. I mean, I don't know the insides of Maiden, but they have to fly in for rehearsals, don't they?
Right. Yeah. So basically then, how quick did you go on the tour then?
Well, there was a little pause. I think the auditions were about, this was in 1994, I think the auditions were in about May. Actually, this is the fun part of the book. So I went through my old diaries, and you get to the end of the book, the camera's there, and I've got literally day by day everything happened. Right, so you say, how long a wait was there? Right, well, I'll look it up exactly, right? So the first audition was on April the 26th, 1994. The second audition was May the 10th, 1994. The rehearsals started, I've got all the rehearsal dates, on August the 1st. And the first show was September the 1st in Springfield, Missouri.
All right.
When I told Bruce I was going to do this book, I told him that, I went through all my old diaries and wrote out the whole timescale for those whole 2 years, day by day, with every rehearsal, every recording thing. Bruce just looked at me like I was mad. I was like, I don't have that shit. Why have you got all that?
Yeah.
And actually, when I was doing it at the time, I mean, I just happened to keep a bit of a diary, and we were taking photos because it was fun.
Yeah.
And... yeah, you collect your backstage passes. I'm sure you do. I see you've got your drum skin on the wall and stuff. You collect things, don't you?
Yeah, of course.
And so I wasn't collecting with the idea of making a book. But, of course, when I started making the book, I've got everything here. And then fans were asking on the Facebook group, the Skunkworks Facebook group that I started, they were saying things like, one of them said, I remember he said, when was the first time that you played Iron Maiden The Prisoner? Because we... played that in the set list once, and I went, oh, hang on, I'll look at it. And I came back with, that was April the 22nd, 1995.
All right.
I was really meaning roughly what tour you did it on. I'm like, oh, sorry, but literally the book has got everything you want to know.
Right. Yeah. What's basically the first tour? Was it with Helloween?
No, the first tour actually was in America.
Right.
And the headliner was Jackal. Do you remember them? Jackal. They had a beautiful song called She Loves My Cock.
Okay.
They were honestly absolutely insane. There were some guys from Tennessee. They had a few hits in America. They did pretty well over there. And they toured Europe a couple of times, but America was definitely their thing. They were playing with chainsaws on stage.
All right.
Right. The singer's got long hair like you. Now imagine waving a chainsaw around without tying your hair.
Yeah.
And also, they were going on stage with, he went on stage with a shotgun, which we all thought was funny, you know.
Yeah.
But we assumed that it probably wasn't loaded or maybe blanks. And one day he shot a hole in the roof of the venue.
Hell?
Police were called in. They had Bucking Bronco on stage, you know, like those kind of animated robotic cows.
Okay.
And you get on top and you play rodeo.
All right.
And they'd get topless girls out of the audience.
Yeah.
To get on the Bucking Bronco. Okay. It was a crazy show. It was an absolute insane party. And the whole tour was like that as well. It was absolute madness.
Right.
And there was Jackal headlining, and then us second on the bill, all a bit confused by what the shit is going on with these crazy Americans, you know? And then third on the bill was Richie Kotzen. who obviously at the time he just left Poison. Later, obviously, he's gone on to Mr. Big, Winery Dogs, and Adrian Smith recently. But yeah, it was such an odd bill. But I think as well, being 1994, I think what we saw was like the very last of the, you know, the Motley Crue Rat era of crazy touring with groupies and backstage parties and stupid drugs that people shouldn't be doing and Jack Daniels everywhere. And and that was our first experience touring with Bruce. We were just thrown in at the deep end of that. Oh, shit.
That was good to do when you were young still.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it was a good party time. And then after that, we did a full European tour headlining for the Balls to Picasso album. We did UK tour. Then we recorded a live album at the Marquee.
This is called the Live in Studio A.
Yeah.
All right.
A Live in Studio A. It was a bit of an odd idea. We, like I say, we recorded the live show at the Marquee. And then a couple of days later, we went into Metropolis Studios and we went into Studio A. Studio A, B and C. So that's why it's called Alive in Studio A. And recorded the set again. Kind of like, you know, just in a studio. It was a bit weird. But and then that was released as a double CD. Then after that, we did the Sarajevo show. Which obviously, have you seen Scream for Me Sarajevo?
Yeah, I went to see it in the movie theater in,
in
Helsinki.
Yeah, so.
It was pretty cool.
Yeah, that was pretty heavy. I'm so glad we made that film. I think, you know, it's documented it really well. I would recommend that really above anything else I've ever done, you know. If you want to buy the book, that's great. If you want to buy the Skunkworks album, that's great. But really, get Scream for Me Sarajevo. That's
I don't know. Is it basically, can people watch it somewhere still?
Yeah, it's live streaming. You can
Know some place where it could be watched.
Yeah, the place to go is Scream for Me Sarajevo.
Okay, from the website.
Yeah, ScreamForMeSarajevo.com has got the links to streaming. And you can buy DVD. It's still on Amazon.
It was pretty like, when I was watching it, I think it was, you had that gig there in the in the venue. And I think it was the Son of a Gun song, maybe, which you played there.
I think that it was funny. We only had a small bit of footage from the actual concert. I think it was Gods of War that we've got footage of from the concert.
All right, actually, yes, it was Gods of War. That was the song. When I was watching it, I was crying in the, when watching it in the movie
theater.
I cry
every time I watch it.
That was super emotional, super awesome performance, that one.
So again, you know, I mean, going doing a gig in the middle of the Bosnian War, this was pretty crazy.
Yes.
And so this whole touring experience, you know, from Jackal's crazy party antics to a gig in the middle of the Bosnian War.
Bit different setting.
Yeah, you know, we weren't expecting it to be quite this crazy. We knew that joining a band with Bruce Dickinson was going to be fun and we were going to tour the world. But we didn't know quite what he was in for. And I think one of the things, you know, I said earlier, we went out for a drink after the first audition. And he did say there, and I should have known, he said that Maiden had become, because they're so massive, and they've got this big stage set and they're known for all that, it was kind of impossible to do small gigs. They had to tour with several trucks. And he said, I want a band that can do the big shows, but can also play anywhere. And I thought, oh, that sounds good. Yeah, I want to play anywhere. I didn't think anywhere meant inside an active war zone.
True.
That was, sounds a bit of a shock. Yeah, it was a quick growing up experience. That's real life for you.
A little bit reality. What can be happening and what is happening in the world.
Absolutely. And it's what's happening in Ukraine, you know. So when I watch the news in Ukraine, I know totally what's going on. It's absolute horror. What we're seeing on the news is the tip of the iceberg, I'm sure of it. They're going to be digging up mass graves for years to come, I promise you.
Yeah, there's some really cool stuff from the, I think from the European leg on YouTube. For example, the Cyclops live. There's at least footage from Tavastia Helsinki.
Yeah, that's great.
But that, I think that was the one, or was that basically when you were, when Halloween was, were you supporting Halloween there?
No, that was, that was, yeah, that Tavastia show was headlining on the Balls to Picasso tour.
Yeah.
And it's quite funny because, of course, we didn't officially film any of the shows on that tour.
Yeah.
But someone filmed it clearly.
Fan filmed, yeah.
From balcony with a great view of the whole stage. And I'm so glad they did. Yeah. If whoever filmed it is listening, please accept my thanks that you saved the day. Because otherwise we would have had no footage, because back then people didn't film on their phones. You know, everything gets filmed now. Yeah. But back then it was a rarity, and that's great quality. Yeah.
And I think there's also cool stuff. I just watched it more recently. And I earlier as well posted some clip from Milan of the particular Cyclops, like a live thing. That's like a super goosebumps material there.
Oh, cool.
I will put the link to the description of it for people to check it out. It's super like cool footage.
Yeah.
Really dig that song. And the performance there is somehow super energetic and cool.
Yeah, and again, Bruce was like, you know, as a boss and as a musical leader, he was so relaxed about the whole thing. He didn't want everything done note for note the same as Balls to Picasso. He was just like, make it your own thing. You know, he's a big Deep Purple fan, and Deep Purple is all about jamming. And that's where he was coming from. So he wasn't like, learn everything exactly the same. I want it. He was just like, yeah, do what you want with it, mess around. Yeah. And we'd mess around with it. Yeah.
It had cool intro
and he was
or something.
Fine with it,
How you did it.
And it was kind of weird, I thought, starting with a slow song. But
that was brilliant. For me, like that's super cool.
Mm. And then we'd come out, and of course, it would just be the three of us at first. And then when Bruce came out, there'd be a massive scream.
It worked great.
Yeah.
And like I could see from those footages of the term animosity of Bruce there, you know, like you could see that he was really like, you know, believing in what you guys were doing there.
Absolutely.
You can
sense
it from the energy of that footage.
Yeah.
Super cool stuff.
Yeah, he was totally up for it. I think for him it was... he'd got bored of Iron Maiden.
Mm.
And so for him it was like something exciting to do, playing smaller venues with a different band and jamming and messing around. He'd have us playing blues and stuff in the middle of the show and bringing up random cover versions midway through a gig and just messing around with the set as much as possible, you know?
Yeah.
Which is something that Maiden... can't and don't do, you know? And so I think for him it was like having a break.
Mm.
And actually I think looking back on that whole period, I think, you know, I know the fans didn't really get it sometimes when we played smaller venues, but looking back, you know, the fans got to hear some really different music from Bruce.
Mm.
Like, you know, from Chemical Wedding to Accident of Birth or Skunk Works or Balls to Picasso's. You're getting a very different vibe from the guy than what you got in Maiden. You also got to hear Maiden do different stuff with Blaze. And you got to see both bands in smaller venues, which is always cool. Yeah. And then when they came back as Maiden and they reformed for Brave New World, they suddenly had loads more energy.
Yeah.
So I think they actually needed that break. Mm. You know, we all need a holiday. And for them, it was like a 3-4 year holiday of like, right, I've had enough of you. And I'm sure they'd all had enough of each other, you know. Yeah. Like, right, let's have a break. And they didn't plan it like that. But then, of course, after a while, they probably thought, you know what, it was kind of cool playing big venues with Maiden and being quite successful. Yeah. And yeah, Steve's not so bad, you know.
Yeah.
Kind of like, you know, getting back with an ex-girlfriend and going, yeah, you know what, we did have good times together, didn't we? And now, of course, Maiden have gone on to more success than they ever had before. Mm. And I don't know if that would have happened if Bruce had stayed in the band all the way through, because it wouldn't have been exciting.
Mm.
And the way they are now, I went to see them in Croatia and in Paris, stronger than ever.
Yeah.
And considering, like, I mean, they're all 10 years older than me or something. They're in their 60s and stuff and rocking out. Amazing energy.
Yeah. There's also some footage in which I saw even posted by some Finnish music magazines online. There's some, I think it's from the Post Picasso, some promo tour where there's Alex Dixon and Bruce doing some like acoustic stuff in Kaisaniemi, like next to your hotel where you were staying.
Oh yeah.
Was that basically on the tour, or was it a separate promo tour, that one?
That was around the time that me and the drummer were auditioning.
Okay.
When me and Alex were auditioning, Bruce and Alex Dixon, obviously it's confusing having two people called Alex in the back. But Bruce and Alex Dixon were doing acoustic shows around the world just to promote the record and sign some records and get the whole thing started.
Mm.
So they did they did something in Finland. They did a few dotted around Europe. Yeah. They went to America as well and
right.
a bit of Asia. I'm not sure exactly where they went, but there was that going on.
There's some really cool footage of that.
Which again, you know, Maiden wouldn't do an acoustic two-man show.
Yeah, of course.
In your local record right. shop to promote the new album.
Yeah.
And that again was great for fans. They get to really see him close up there.
Yes. It's cool footage. I will link that as well here. Super cool stuff. So how was basically then how was your group then called the Skunk Works?
That was, Bruce, you know, we all got on great and musically it was sounding good, we thought. And Bruce wanted to make it a band name. Yeah. And he chose the name Skunk Works because he's into aeroplanes and it's the name of a US base where they try out experimental planes.
Oh, okay.
Like Lockheed Blackbird and stuff like that was designed there. So that's his thing, you know, stealth bombers and stuff like that. So he called it Skunk Works. But it really was, you know, him calling it Skunk Works because essentially, you know, he's the one selling the tickets.
Mm.
It's his name on the posters, you know, really. It's not a band. It's his band, you know? Which is absolutely fine by us. And we didn't really actually want it to be a band in that kind of completely equal democracy because it was unrealistic, you know? And it would make no sense for him anyway, you know? He's been in this industry 10 years and been quite successful.
Yeah.
It would be kind of odd if I had the same, you know, vote in the band as he did, you know? And it was his career. And yeah, we were called Skunk Works as a band name, but basically it was still obviously the Bruce Dickinson band underneath.
Yeah, right. Yeah, then there came the Back from the Edge, did the music video. It's a cool song, and I guess in the video, Bruce is in some kind of like a aquarium. Or how did that video shooting go?
Yeah, that was... So what happened was Bruce was directing the video himself.
Oh, okay.
And we also filmed both videos, Inertia and Back from the Edge, at the same time. And Bruce had found with this director, Jeremy Aziz, they'd found a location in Battersea in London where it was, I'm not sure the original purpose of this place, but it was like one house building. It was quite a big place with a swimming pool in one room, but it was kind of semi-derelict. It wasn't being used for anything, this building, I couldn't work out. And all sorts of other odd rooms and odd-shaped places. So both videos were shot in the same building, but just in different rooms. And it looks like different locations all over the place, you know. In Inertia, you've got a complete white background. That was already there. And then Back from the Edge, we're in a dark room with a strobe light. That was a different room in the same building.
Right.
And the swimming pool was in the same building.
Yeah.
And then we filmed a little bit in the garden of the building. So both videos were done in the same building in 2 days. Mm. So it was a bit of a hurry. But yeah, there was this swimming pool and Bruce had this idea to sing underwater. So yeah, in Back from the Edge, you see him, he's got his coat on and he's underwater. It's freezing cold.
Okay.
and he's miming, singing the words along.
Yeah.
And it genuinely is one take. You can watch it closely. There's no edit there.
You couldn't take more takes. So cold.
No, but just if you watch it next time or anyone listening, watch that video and just try holding your breath for the amount of time that he does it. Bearing in mind, he's underwater, freezing cold, trying to swim and trying to mime the lyrics.
Yeah.
And you just sit calmly in a seat and hold your breath and see if you've got the same lung capacity as him. I was pretty impressed. I couldn't do it.
Impressive performance.
Yeah, absolutely.
Then there's the album cover. Is it some famous location where it was taken? Or just some, like, I guess it's a mirrored.
Yeah, like, it's a mirrored image. It was Storm Ferguson, was the legendary artist, art designer. You know, he did Pink Floyd and Led Zeppelin.
Okay, he's that guy, stuff.
And Scorpions, and he's done some amazing album covers. And him and Bruce had this idea for, a lake with two trees and two men, but mirror imaged. And I don't know if you noticed, but if you get the vinyl version and then the re-released vinyl or the CD and the single covers, they're all actually slightly different photos.
Oh, okay.
And I've never seen this done before, where you know, Number of the Beast has one cover. It doesn't have several different covers.
Yeah.
But Skunkworks does have different covers.
All right.
And it was all this guy, Storm and Bruce's idea to have this image. And they sent some photographers up to Scotland to just find a lake that looks nice and take some photos.
Yeah.
So they did that, and then it came back and Storm pieced it all together. Right. I must admit, I was a little bit confused by it. Okay, so two guys standing next to a lake, and that depicts...
Yeah.
What exactly? And how does that relate to Skunkworks, the aircraft factory? And actually, how does Skunkworks, the aircraft factory, and the lake relate to anything in the songs?
Yeah.
And I think that was one of the problems of that whole project, was just confusion.
Okay.
And I'm not sure if it was intended to be mysterious, but I think
I guess it's just like, you know, getting along the way, kind of improvising a little bit. Like, this seems like cool, let's add this.
Yeah, and then let's have a bit of this, and then let's put a squirrel in there.
Yeah.
Or, you know. And I think, you know, looking at... I think Fear of the Dark is a great example, right? That front cover of the Fear of the Dark album shows Eddie being quite creepy in the dark.
Yeah.
And the song Fear of the Dark has the lyric Fear of the Dark quite a lot of times over.
Yeah.
And the lyrics are about being scared of the dark. And also, all of us at some point in our childhood have been scared of the dark, had nightmares in our bedroom or whatever, so we can relate to it.
Yeah.
And so the whole package fits together to give you a really clear image of what's going on.
Yeah.
And Skunkworks was the total opposite, where there's just no theme. Some of the songs are a bit heavy, some of them are quite light. I think most of them are pretty good, but there wasn't cohesion.
Maybe that's why Skunkworks was a fitting name for it. It's a little bit like, I don't know, skunks, those animals. Well, a little bit like,
again,
they do weird confusion stuff.
Yeah, because that's it. Fans were thinking, what's this about? What's the title? Does it mean Skunk the Animal or Skunk?
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
You know, I was in the band and I don't know what was going on. So if I didn't know what was going on, the fans had no clue at all.
So it's Skunkworks.
It was an experimental period. That's really what was going on. You know, Bruce was wanting to experiment with music and images and try his own thing. And, you know, and even directing the video himself, that wouldn't have happened in Maiden. I don't think they'd have let him direct a video. I might be wrong there, but, you know, so he got to try out doing all the things he wanted to do. Yeah. He wants to jam Deep Purple covers in the middle of a gig. Yeah, sure, mate.
Yeah.
You want to put a lake on the album cover? Go for it. But I'm just imagining some rock fan goes into the local record shop and he's heard there's a new album out by Bruce Dickinson and there's this picture of a lake. Is that what we're getting? Okay.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, Maiden fans want to see Eddie or some demon or devil or scary monster. And okay, we don't have to copy Maiden, but... I don't know. I mean, looking back, it's easy to say where things went wrong.
Yeah.
But at the time, it all seemed fine, and we just went along with anything that was happening, really.
Yeah, but of course, then again, I guess the style was a little bit something a bit different on purpose as well. Like, you know, from it was a bit like a differing, a little bit, I guess, alternative edge somewhat in the...
Alternative was the word, yeah. That was exactly it. Right. It was just doing something different.
Yeah.
That's all Bruce wanted to do. He didn't come into the thing with an idea of, like, we need to sound like this. I want us to go in the Led Zeppelin vibe, or I want us to be modern. He just said, let's do something different.
Right.
And so Alex Dixon, the guitarist, as I said earlier, is a great songwriter. He just wrote loads of different songs.
Yeah.
And said, do you like this one? Do you like this one? Do you like this one? And Bruce loved them all.
Yeah.
So we basically did, like, I think the album ended up with, like, the first 12 songs that Alex demoed. But Alex actually demoed about 20 or 30 songs. He doesn't stop writing. He's a prolific writer. And we went into rehearsal studio. One of the great things about Bruce's band was we were given so much rehearsal time, which I think is a luxury that most bands can't afford. You know, you can't afford to go to a rehearsal studio 6-7 days a week and have it block booked out from morning till night. And we could.
Yeah.
So we did. And so we went through these songs, the rough ideas that Alex came up with, and we just played them backwards and forwards over and over again. Bruce would come in, try some lyrics, didn't quite work, write something else the next day. I'd be trying to get the bass line to fit better and lock in with the drums more and just really work on the whole thing before going in the studio.
Mm.
And of course, these days, it's entirely different. And obviously, I see your recording setup. You can record at home. You can do as many takes as you want. Mm. And of course, it's not like that back in the day. Mm. We really had to do the homework in the rehearsals.
Yeah.
And then when we go into the studio, we totally know what we're going to record.
Right.
And it's going to be something just different from what Maiden are doing.
Mm. Yeah. Which studio was it and how was it recorded? Was it, I guess, of course, it was analog studio. And, but did you do it like live takes, like bass and drums first, and how was the process?
Yeah, actually we did often just guitar and drums, or guitar, bass and drums. So the three of us would be playing, or sometimes just Alex and Alex would be playing, and record the drums. And then I'd go in and play the bass the next morning. But it was in a residential studio, and again, this costs a lot of money. It was in like a manor house. It was Linford Manor, just north of London. And it was residential, so we lived there, or certainly three of us lived there, me, Alex, and Alex, and Jack, the producer. And we had a cook come in and cook for us, and we had a pool table, a room with a snooker room, and like, it was amazing, just complete luxury, you know.
Yeah.
And Bruce had come in and out. He stayed there a few times more and more when he was doing his vocals, but he'd be in and out because he's busy doing press and flying planes and everything. But the fact that we had that luxury of just totally living the record, you know, so you get up first thing in the morning and go down barely dressed and have your breakfast and just start rocking out and playing a few songs and then have a break for lunch and then get back in and do a bit more. And then in the evening, hang around together, talking about music, listening to what we've done, how it could be improved, and then start laying down the guitars on top. And again, that was such luxury that we could live our whole lives like that. Because right now, you know, my life's a bit different. I've got a kid and I'm not going to spend 6 weeks in a studio morning till night. But that's what we did back then.
Mm. Yeah, kind of like a little bit like lifestyle, living in the studio.
Absolutely. And we did that the whole couple of years. We were just, Alex and Alex lived, they shared a place together. And I lived just over the road from them and Bruce was just around the corner. So we were all within touch all the time.
Yeah.
And in my back garden, I had a soundproof studio.
Right.
And so we could be jamming in there. And when we weren't jamming in there, we'd book a proper studio with Bruce and then he could come down and sing. And so it was just constant all the time. Yeah, really living being in a band.
Yeah.
And there was kind of nothing else going on in our lives at the time. We didn't have families and external hobbies didn't exist. This is just what we did all day, every day.
Yeah.
It's a really intense period, actually.
Yeah. So did you say a soundproof studio at your backyard or like a, was it some like a warehouse or?
No, it was me and a friend of mine were looking for somewhere to rent.
Right.
And we just went to an estate agent and show us around some flats. And there's this woman showing us around a flat. And the living room is okay and there's two bedrooms. Yeah, that looks good. Kitchen's okay. And she said to us, this woman, this estate agent, she didn't know what she was showing us. You would spot it straight away. She said, there's a bit of a strange shed in the back. And we went, really? Let's have a look. And there was this concrete shed, a couple of windows, and it was split into two rooms. One room was quite narrow and was smaller than the other room. There was quite a lot of power points along the wall. And we also noticed as soon as we went in, there's two doors on the way in. And when you open one, it goes...
Yeah.
And the other one goes... Someone soundproofed this.
Nice.
And the walls are all carpeted. And the first thing we do when we go in there, me and my mate was a bass player as well, first thing we do is like... Yeah, okay, we'll take this.
Yeah.
And the estate agent's going, oh, it's a weird place, this. I wonder why they put all the PowerPoints there. Go, don't you worry about that. We'll take it. Here's the deposit. So we rented ourselves a place that already had a rehearsal studio set up in the back garden. Or actually, it was set up for recording. You could have put a desk in the other room, but we didn't have a desk at the time. So that was great because literally it was properly soundproofed, like I say, with the double doors and double glazed windows.
Exactly.
So we were in there till 2 or 3 in the morning sometimes playing around. We got neighbours, but no one can hear it.
Nice.
Yeah, that was again such a luxury to be able to play. And like I say, when we weren't in there, we were in proper rehearsals or we were out on tour. And actually, we were finding, the three of us especially, were finding on tour, was frustrating because we couldn't play all day.
Mm.
We weren't playing enough on tour.
Right.
Because we could only do our sound check for an hour, and then we get the show for an hour and a half. And then your guitars are taken away from you by the crew, and they're loaded into flight cases and put in a truck.
Mm.
And then you have a day off in a hotel, and we're like, can we break into the truck and get the guitars out? I want to set up and I want to get playing. Because we were just addicted to playing all day and all night, you know. And it was just that time of life. That's what we were all about. Yeah.
But that would be, of course, like, that's how you... What is a little bit the problem in my situation at the moment, that I kind of like, you know, our rehearsal space is further away. You need to always travel there. And with the drums, it's like, it would be nice to be able to play constantly.
Absolutely.
So that's... how you are able to, it becomes then a second nature of the playing.
Absolutely. And then the band becomes really good. Mm. And then it's just not the same when you just play with someone else. And obviously we've all been in situations where you come in, you do one quick rehearsal with a band and then you play the show that night. Or sometimes you just get sent some songs and told, learn this, there's a show tonight, and you just do it. And you somehow do it and you get away with it because you're okay at playing and it's all quite fun.
Yeah.
But it's never going to be as tight as what the Skunk Works band was.
Right.
I put some stuff, I put quite a lot on my YouTube channel with some rehearsals of us playing.
Oh.
There's all the demos that Alex Dixon did.
Right.
And there's also some of us jamming. The jamming songs are under the name Pasta Power Trio.
Uh-huh.
And if you look up Pasta Power Trio, we're doing ridiculous things. Like in one of them, we start playing the Trooper. And then suddenly halfway through, it goes into a kind of reggae version of the Trooper. And then it goes into some jazz section. And then we're off into a Deep Purple song somewhere. And this is what we were doing in our spare time, just really messing around with music and totally taking it to the edge of our abilities.
Yeah.
Again, because we had the time. And I'm sure you find now, like you're saying about your rehearsal space, I'm sure there's a day when you're going to rehearse, but then the guitarist can't make it because his boss said he's got to go to work on Sunday, and the bass player can't be there because his wife's got to take her mum to hospital. And that's real life, and it gets in the way of all of us, you know. Yeah. But back then, we were lucky enough that there was no real life distracting us at all.
Right, right. Is it on video, the stuff, or audio stuff?
Just audio.
All right.
Yeah.
Do you have any video footage of the... you know, the recording sessions of the Skunk Works?
No, again, everyone's got it on their phone these days. It's so easy. Yeah. But back then...
you would need to have a VHS guy
in the band. And it would be this big chunky camera on your shoulder, wouldn't it? Yeah. No, but I see your little GoPro there. If we had those, you would have some amazing footage.
Yeah, exactly.
But I'm just glad we recorded so much of it. Alex Dixon was recording all the time while we were doing stuff, just to get an idea of what... And then, of course, in the evening... we'd sit around, have a couple of drinks and listen to what we'd been playing and then improving on that. And then when we were out on tour, on the Balls to Picasso tour, we decided one of our hobbies was going to be, we were going to learn the first two Aussie albums in soundcheck. So when Bruce didn't turn up to a soundcheck, we'd be playing Diary of a Madman or Believer or I Don't Know and all the others. And again, we'd then in the evening after the show, we'd be on the bus listening to Diary of a Madman again, checking out where we went wrong in rehearsal. So the next day when we can go into the soundcheck, we can get Diary of a Madman slightly tighter and slightly better. Right. And yeah, you've got that drum fill wrong. And it's the offbeat thing they switched to. Yeah, we'll have to get that right.
Yeah.
So we were constantly trying to improve ourselves.
Right. When you were basically doing it, I guess you were then headlining band because you had time to have a soundtrack, proper soundcheck.
Yeah, but to be fair, when we were supporting Halloween, we got sound checks as well.
All right. Yeah. When was the Halloween support?
Well, the Halloween tour was originally set up to be part of the kind of extended Balls to Picasso tour after, after we'd done South America or something. See, the great thing is I don't have to have a memory because I've got the book, right? And this will show exactly what was going on. Because we got to the end of the Balls Picasso tour and we were supposed to do some dates in Europe with Halloween. Poster of the cancelled dates.
Okay.
Because there's everything in this book. So. Yeah, so it was supposed to happen in 95. Those dates got cancelled. And then we made the Skunk Works album.
Yeah.
And then we were going to tour with Halloween for the Skunk
Works. For the Skunk Works.
Yeah.
All right.
And there was a bit of doubt amongst some of us about, is Halloween the right band to be going out touring with the Skunk Works album? But we were in a bit of we were in a bit of a stuck place because Helloween were on Sanctuary Management, same as Bruce and same as Maiden. Mm. So it was nice and easy to put the package together from the booking agent point of view. So that was nice and easy and possible. But then the strange thing about Skunkworks, of course, here's Bruce, who's known for Iron Maiden, playing some relatively new style music, and yet new style bands wouldn't really want Bruce as their opening act because he's comes from the old school. And so we couldn't really go, you know, we couldn't go out with Pearl Jam or someone like that. They wouldn't be interested. They'd want some up-and-coming band. So we were stuck going out with Helloween. I say stuck going out with Helloween.
That doesn't sound bad.
It was great fun. It was brilliant. But it might not have been the best place to try selling the Skunkworks album to.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, we went out and we did it, and it was great fun, and we got on with Helloween really well.
Yeah.
And that was another thing in the book. I'm going through, like, answering fans' questions and getting different people involved. And one of the fans came in with, what did you think of Helloween? It's like, yeah, great guys. They put on a great show. It was very different from what we were doing. Old school metal, but done very well. And I thought, actually, the more interesting question from the perspective of this book is what did Helloween think of us? Mm-hmm. So I messaged Roland Grapov because we're still in touch. And he came back with his ideas about what he thought of Skunkworks. Yeah. So that's the good thing about this book that I like, is different people views. Yeah. If it was just my autobiography, it'd be quite boring. It'd be like this interview, you know. But the book has got everybody's angle, and it kind of reads like, I hope it reads like some friends just sitting around a table having a chat, you know.
Yeah.
I remember when we went there. Oh, yeah, that was funny, wasn't it? It was some fan going, so how did you do that? What was Helloween like?
And, yeah.
But the Helloween tour was great because we got to play to bigger audiences than we would have done. And then we filmed live video at the end of the tour. And so the Skunkworks live video is in front of an audience of 4,000 in an arena in Spain, and it looks great. But what you don't notice is that's actually a support slot. That's Helloween's audience, not us. We didn't have 4,000 fans ready for us in Spain. Yeah. But Helloween did. So it was great exposure and good to go out on. Right. And the tour lasted ages. It was like a couple of months. Again, I can look up the exact dates in the book. Yeah. But so, yeah, it was good fun. But it was slightly odd in that some of the venues, like Tavastia here in Helsinki, we'd already headlined that on Bulls to Picasso tour. Right. And then we come back kind of opening for Helloween.
Mm.
I say kind of, because it was billed as a double headline in some places.
Mm.
And some places even had Bruce higher up on the poster than Helloween.
Okay.
But actually what was always going on was Helloween was headlining. They were playing the main set and they were playing their full show for an hour and a half and we were playing like an hour.
Yeah.
So we were definitely the support band, although it was billed in some places as double headline. But again, that was a good fun tour. I enjoyed that. But then I read in Bruce's book that he found it depressing.
Oh, really?
And I think this is the curious thing, and this is why I had several people writing bits for my book, is because everyone's memories are slightly different and everyone's angle looking at it. I mean, my angle is like, I quite like German beer. And we had like 3 or 4 weeks touring in Germany with a German band.
Yeah.
And I could practice speaking German and I could drink beer and eat schnitzel. And I was having a great time. Bruce was probably wandering around thinking at some point, like, hang on, Helloween used to open for Maiden and now I'm the support band. And so his view on it would be totally different to mine, you know. And whereas I'm looking at the audience in Spain going, wow, there's 4,000 kids going crazy. Bruce is probably going, oh, there's only 4,000. Rock in Rio was 120,000. You know, so we've got different views on the whole thing, which is why I think, you know, I did write this after reading Bruce's book. And I must admit, part of the inspiration of doing this was reading Bruce's book and me looking at it going, no, I saw that differently. that's true, but it's a different angle.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's have the other side of this, you know. It's not so bad to tour Germany with Helloween, you know. I think you'd probably enjoy it.
Yeah, possibly.
What could go wrong?
Yeah.
There's a photo of us recording the Skunkworks album. I probably can't find it right now. And it's the drummer in the studio, Alex Elena.
Okay.
And see, there he is doing the recording.
Right.
And then a friend of mine who's a sound engineer saw the photo and he went, that's a really strange way to mic up a drum kit, isn't it? And you've got a chimney right behind you. Wouldn't that cause echo? And the overheads seem really low. And I was like, ah, fair point. I never thought about it too much. So I got in touch with Jack Endino, the producer, and like, come on, Jack, tell us why you mic'd up the drum kit like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, for a drummer who likes recording like yourself, yeah, to have a question like that in there, you know, Bruce's book doesn't go into drum miking techniques.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, I must say, there's probably going to be some readers that will kind of maybe skip the bit about drum mic technique. So be it. But, you know, you'll be straight in there.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So I am still in touch a lot with the Skunk Works guys or Bruce these days.
Yeah, Alex Dixon not, unfortunately.
Right.
Alex Dixon, guitarist, the three of us were like best mates at the time in the band. And long afterwards me and Alex were best mates and we did other projects together. We did Sack Trick together and we played with different bands. And I'm quite an outgoing guy and like a laugh and a smile and stuff. And Alex is really shy. And as the years went by, he became more and more shy and more withdrawn and more quiet to the point where he moved to a little place in Scotland. You laughed at my Nokia phone.
Hey, he doesn't have it. I appreciate it.
he doesn't have a phone at all.
Oh, all right.
He lives next to a lake in Scotland.
All right.
It's probably the one that Skunk Works album was done at. I don't know. And I haven't heard from him for a couple of years.
All right.
And it's a real shame because great friends, but if he wants to stay quiet and stay to himself, that's his business, you know.
Yeah.
Me and Alex Elena still like brothers. We talk all the time. We get on great. And every time we catch up, we live in different countries, but every time we catch up, it's like time hasn't passed.
Yeah, exactly.
We're back together. And with Bruce, it was, I mean, obviously in the band, it was all fine and fun.
Mm.
But there was always an element of, like, he's my boss.
Mm.
And I don't want to be an arse in front of him. I don't want to say something too stupid. I said a lot of stupid things, but I try not to be too stupid in front of him. In case he fires us all or whatever, because you always worry about your job, you know.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's the same with any job. You go out for a drink with your boss after work and you're still a little bit careful.
Yeah.
And I don't want to, you know, I'm not getting naked. I'm not dancing on the table, you know. But the thing is, after the band, I did an album with the other two, with the two Alexes, called Mystery Rabbits, which was a silly album by my band Sack Trick. I just did it for fun. And then I called Bruce up and said, just made this fun album with Sack Trick with the other two guys. I think you should hear it. And he said, oh, great, yeah, stick it in the post. And I said, nah, can I pop round and play it for you? And he was like, oh, yeah, if you like, you know where I live. So I went over to his place for the album. And we listened to it. It's a funny album, and we both laughed along. And I found that we were getting on better because now he's not my boss, and I don't have this thing in the back. He's just another guy, and he's a singer, and he's a very good singer, but he's just another guy. And we've been through some crazy experiences together. We went through the Bosnian War together, and we've been touring around America together, and we've got a lot in common, actually. And me and Bruce are both interested in history and languages and stuff, and we share quite a lot. And so I ended up just kind of, probably becoming a better friend after the band than I was in the band.
Mm.
And so since then, you know, I've been to his birthday parties, he's been to my wedding. And it does seem kind of odd that, you know, I go down the pub and have a chat with him. And
so do you still live around those areas? Like
I'm still in the area. And he's a couple of miles down the road from me, and we can meet in a pub.
Right.
And when I was doing this book, I went out and we went for a drink in the pub and told him I was doing the book, and we had a laugh about it and all that.
Yeah.
So it's a lot more relaxed now. And now, you know, like I went to the show in Croatia, and I just texted him, mate, I'm in Zagreb, any chance of guest list? And he's like, yeah, sure, should we catch up for a beer? Yeah, good idea, you know? Mm. It's all completely casual, which is quite funny, because obviously every now and then you still think, actually, he is the lead singer of Iron Maiden. he is incredibly famous. But then again, we've known each other for years.
He is a human also.
This is the thing, which I think some of the fans don't quite realise, essentially. You know, one of the things, when I was running this Facebook group, a couple of people did write in saying, like, you know, they were saying their experience of having met him for 10 minutes in an airport when he was hurrying to get another flight. And they said, you know, he seemed a bit, he didn't want to talk to his fans. And other people are saying, oh my, is he a god? You know, how did he write these lyrics? And no, he's just a human being. He's a very he's a talented human being, and he's an intelligent human being, and he's got lots of different interests, and he happens to be an incredibly good singer. But he is a human being, and if he's late for a flight, he will ignore people and run for the flight.
Yeah, of course.
And, you know, I've got a flight in a couple of hours. Yeah. And if I'm late for it and someone's trying to talk to me, I will completely ignore them and run for my flight. Yeah, most people would do that, you know. And sometimes he's out for dinner with a friend or with his girlfriend or something. Mid-conversation, a fan comes over and wants a chat. And he's not always up for it, you know. Or also sometimes, you know, I quite like being by myself sometimes. Mm. Having a bit of quiet time, you know. Sometimes I'll sit in a pub with my laptop and have a drink and write some stuff on the computer. And if some guy comes over and goes, oh, you look lonely. Can I join you, mate? It's like, actually, no, I'm having a good time by myself. And I see that with Bruce sometimes where fans have gone, oh, he was sat by himself doing nothing. So I thought I'd go and tell him about what I thought of Seventh Son. I'm like, no, please don't do that. Just leave him alone. He wants a bit of quiet time, you know. So he's not an arsehole, but he's also not a god, you know. He does have faults. He's a human being, you know.
Yeah. So basically, last night you had the Iron Maiden tribute thing, and you did play some, you went also to play some of the Bruce songs. Which songs did you play with the guys?
We did Laughing in the Hiding Bush, and Tears of the Dragon, and Inner Space off the Skunk Works album.
Right. Nice.
Yeah, it was quite funny, actually. It's a really cool local band called Bone Button who do their Iron Maiden set usually. And I said to them, oh, could you learn a few songs off the Skunk Works album? And they came back going, it's a little confusing how to learn Skunk Works songs. I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, sorry. Let's play Tears of the Dragon then. But they were great. They were great. And it was nice. I mean, it's lovely to be invited over to these things and, you know, a chance to promote the book and hang out with fans and people and have a beer and everybody's nice and fun. Yeah. And of course, as I was telling you earlier, Dennis Stratton was there. So it was a bit of a maiden fest. You've got Steve Loopy Newhouse, who was one of their original crew guys, who's got his book out that says it's in Finnish now, which is highly recommended for fun and laughs and the true story of early Iron Maiden. And he was there giving a chat. And then you've got Dennis Stratton, who's the guitarist on the first Maiden album, giving a chat and getting up and playing some of those early Maiden songs. And then I was going to give a chat and play some of the Bruce songs. And when the promoter guys got in touch with me and asked me about this, and they said, would you mind getting up and playing some Bruce songs? I'm like, no, that's fine. That'd be a bit of fun. And they said Dennis was getting up as well. And I was like, would it be okay if I got up with Dennis and played a couple of early Maiden songs? Because obviously, in Bruce's band, we did occasionally in the latter years towards the end, we did do some Maiden songs, but obviously they're all from his era. And I'd never played any of the Diano songs. And I'm not the biggest Maiden fan in the world, and I don't have the new album, and I don't follow them religiously. But the idea of playing like Wrathchild and stuff with original Maiden guitarists, that was just too tempting. I was like, I want to do that as well. Yeah. So I said, can I play Wrathchild? And they came back going, Dennis says, yeah, that's fine. He's asking, do you want to do Running Free as well? Okay, well, we're here. Why not? Yeah. You know? So, and it ended up as a great fun party night, you know. Yeah. You never know how these things are going to turn
out.
Yeah,
of course.
You know, you turn up in a strange place and you're wondering, have they sold any tickets or is the equipment going to work? My biggest worry was, you know, there's been a load of flight chaos across Europe recently, and guitars have gone missing, and my flight here got cancelled, and I had to rebook. And Finnair was super helpful, unlike British Airways. But it meant I couldn't bring my bass over, and I'm really quite particular about my bass. It's a Warwick Thumb bass that I've had for years, and I played it in the Skunk Works days, and I still play it now. Right. And it's really me, and it fits me, and I love it.
Yeah,
and I couldn't bring it.
Fuck.
And so I had to say, can you ask the Bone Button guys if I can borrow their bass? And then I was just thinking, I hope it's a reasonable bass. I hope it's something playable. I hope the action isn't out here.
Yeah.
And I work as a backline tech in my day job, so I set up people's guitars on tour, and I was just thinking, I can see myself, I'm going to be in the dressing room with an Allen key and a screwdriver, and I'm going to fix his intonation and his action and everything. But no, it was a really nice Fender Precision. It was nice and standard. He had the action nice and low. The only odd thing was he was playing those Steve Harris flat-wound strings. Because Maiden, Steve Harris plays flat-wound, and I'm not used to them. So it was a little bit unfamiliar, but I got through and it was all good fun. And, and the guys in Bone Button were great fun too. And it was, a lovely evening out, you know. Yeah. And that's what I'm finding after all these years is like, you know, back in the day with Skunkworks and that, we did hang out with the fans after shows and stuff. And maybe like the way I've become more familiar with Bruce after all these years, become more familiar with fans and end up like best mates with the fans and hanging out because they're all harmless enough.
And it's all kind of like a, you know, kind of family in a way. It's like
it absolutely
it's like
is.
Lifestyle and a scene, and all are basically fans of music. So
yeah. And once you see these guys at one or two gigs and then you see them at a third one, then you're best mates for life. And and talking of Maiden family, then when I went out to, so I went out to Croatia for a similar event just as the tour was starting. And Paul Di'Anno was there because he's getting medical treatment in Croatia at the moment. And I've known Paul for years in London, you know. I was kind of like a drinking buddy. Mm. So it was great to see him there. And then they wanted, we were going to judge a battle of the bands of local bands playing. And they wanted me and Paul Di'Anno and Linda Harris, Steve's sister, to judge the battle of the bands. So we did that and we got chatting. I'd never met Linda before. And me and Linda getting on absolutely great. And then, you know, you're saying Maiden family. It really is Maiden family when you're hanging out with Steve Harris's sister. And then it turned out I was chatting to her, and her daughter's husband is a teacher at my kid's school.
All right, yeah.
And then you really are into... And then a few years ago, I did a charity gig at a school, and Thomas Gers, Yannick's nephew, was playing in this school band. And I got my kid to get up and play. And so there's the son of the Skunkworks bass player playing with the nephew of Iron Maiden's guitarist. Yeah. And that's Maiden family tree, isn't it?
That's right. So this is basically now your, what, third, fourth time in Finland?
So for Finland, we would have done Tavastia on the Balls to Picasso tour, and then on the Skunkworks tour, opening for Halloween there.
Right.
And then, 2002, we did more gigs with Bruce for the Best Of. And so we played Tuska Festival. But I'm a backline tech. I've been here on tour with loads of other bands since. Been here with Mr. Big. I think twice with Mr. Big. We did Tavastia with Mr. Big, but we did another venue in Helsinki as well with Mr. Big.
You returned to Tavastia.
Yeah. Yes, to see it again.
It's a great venue. In my opinion, it's the best Finnish venue.
It really is a great venue. The way it's laid out, the fact that you can see from everywhere, the balcony's brilliant.
It's great to play and also great to watch the gigs. Like the sounds are great. It's like not too big, not too small. It's just perfect, you know, for an intimate, great show.
Yeah. And then I think the last time I was here would have been Jurassic Festival. I was working for therapy then.
Yeah.
My job is like, you know, I play bass in bands sometimes, and sometimes I'm a bass tech.
Yeah.
So, but looking after Billy Sheehan's basses for Mr. Big, that's a pretty good job anyway, you know.
That's right. But you haven't been to sauna in Finland?
No.
But did you have saunas in England? Or are they different to Finnish saunas?
I've had sauna mostly in Germany.
All right. But they have this, I've been also in Germany, German sauna. They have this like hourglasses you need to put on. At least that sauna which I visited.
Oh, okay. Like,
but you cannot stay there longer than the hourglass time. You need to go out according to German logistics or like a logic.
Maybe we just didn't know that.
I don't know. Maybe it's good that you didn't know.
I remember me and Alex Elena and Andy Derris were having a sauna together once.
Right, in Germany.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I did find it slightly surreal that we're naked with the singer from Halloween. Okay. That's the fun of a sauna, isn't it?
Yeah. Sauna's great.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Especially the Finnish sauna. Not like when I was visiting Pittsburgh, for example, we took a hotel which had a sauna.
Yeah.
But then we went there, this very small, like a pathetic grill where you could little bit put water, like just like nothing of sauna.
Mm.
But that was our like a criteria for picking the hotel. Big disappointment.
Finland, I mean, you are the kings of sauna.
Of course.
You know, Alex Elena used to do the same thing.
Right.
He'd He's from Italy, he's from Rome, yeah. You know, his parents, his grandparents cooked, it's food culture, Italy, you know, he cooks himself. And then he'd go to an Italian restaurant in England and be absolutely disgusted with the food.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. What do you expect? You're from Italy, you know? Yeah. You're from Finland, yeah, you go to a sauna in Pittsburgh, you're not going to find a better one than in Finland, are
Guess
you?
Not, yeah. That was traumatic experience. So what about now, more recently? It's like you said, you are... You're working, like, is it your main job working on with the bands as a technician?
Yeah, I work with, I don't know what I did wrong in a former life, but I work for 80s pop bands mainly, uh-huh, which is kind of ironic because in the 80s, on top of the pops and TV shows in UK, you'd always have Spandau Ballet and ABC and Go West and people like that. But I'd be into Iron Maiden and Motorhead and Ozzy and Kiss. And now I work for Spandau Ballet and ABC and Go West and Nick Kershaw and Midgeur and Bananarama. Right. But you know what? I've come to have a new appreciation of 80s pop music. For the most part, they were incredible songwriters.
Yeah,
there's great melodies going on. Mm. There's some really odd chord changes going on in some of those songs, which I didn't appreciate when I was a kid.
Right.
I would just I wouldn't listen to it. It was like, oh, no, that's that.
Yeah.
And also, I must say, all the guys, and maybe it's because they've grown up now, you know, there's none of them, no one's being an asshole. Everyone's nice and relaxed. Mm. Super chilled gigs, which suits me. I don't need to be picking up drunk drummers, you know, teenage drummers. I can't be dealing with that anymore. Now, let's have adults who play the gig properly and their equipment works.
Yeah.
And that's a pleasure to work with.
Yeah.
And then the funny thing is, the fun irony, the bass player in ABC is a guy called Andy Carr, who was the bass player on the Tattooed Millionaire album for Bruce.
Ah, all right.
So now I'm his technician.
Okay.
And I tune his bass for him and set it up on stage, and then I play Tattooed Millionaire quickly on it.
If you notice it.
And it's great, because me and him get on great, because we've got this funny bond with the whole Bruce background.
Yeah, yeah.
And I interviewed him as well for the book, because, again, I wanted everyone's input on here, and, you know, you see that name Andy Carr on the Tattooed Millionaire album, but nobody actually knows too much about Andy Carr or what he was doing or how he joined the band.
Right.
And it's all in the book.
All right, it's there.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm looking very much forward to checking the book.
I think you're going to enjoy it. I think you're probably not going to get much sleep tonight.
Yeah, maybe so.
It's a big book.
Yeah, it seems to be a lot of info packaged.
Absolutely, yeah.
Set up, yeah.
Like, after Skunkworks finished in 96... Bruce went on, did Accident at Birth, Chemical Wedding with Roy Z in LA. But like I say, me and him were still in touch, meeting up every now and then. And he was actually coming to see my band Sacktrick. He'd come down. He brought Yannick down one time as well. But he came to see Sacktrick one time, and he said to me, oh, and I wasn't expecting this. I'd actually just done an interview with a magazine, and they'd asked me, what do you think's the chances of Bruce reforming the Skunkworks band? And this was in 2001, 2002. And I said, I think the chances are probably zero because he's in Iron Maiden now. Brave New World has gone massive. They're playing the biggest venues ever. What's the chances of him reforming his least successful band ever? That's just not going to happen, is it? A couple of weeks later, Bruce comes to a Sacktrick gig and goes, Chris, I need to put a band together. Really? Are you serious? He's like, yeah. So his Best Of album came out, and he got asked to do some European festivals.
Yeah.
And so obviously the first thing we thought is get Alex Dixon in to play guitar. Alex Elena had moved to America at that point, so he wasn't going to be doing it. But Bruce had just watched the Sacktrick gig, and he said to me, your drummer in Sacktrick seems pretty good. And he is a great drummer, Robin Guy. So Bruce said, ask him if he wants to do it. I was like, okay. And Robin's just packing his drum kit down on stage, and I went up to him while he's packing his kit down. I said, do you want to play a bunch of festivals in Europe with Bruce? And his drum's just like, oh, piss off. Would you just stop pissing around? No, serious. Bruce is over there, and he's asking, he's just watched you play, and he wants you to play these festivals. And Robin's like, oh, what, you serious? Yeah, I guess so, yeah. And then we decided as well, the great thing about that 2002 thing was that the best of album was out, but we weren't trying to promote a new album or a new angle like Skunk Works was, where we really had to push this idea of here's a new band you need to listen to. This was literally just like, and I said to Bruce, are we just playing heavy metal for the kids? And he went, yes, that's exactly what we're doing. So, okay, good. So none of this alternative vibe. I can put my foot on the monitors and headbang away. And he's like, yeah, of course you can. Yeah, great. And then we chatted about set list and we thought, yeah, we want something from each of the solo albums because it's best of solo album. So, and of course, I'd played Tattooed Millionaire before and Tears of the Dragon and stuff, but I'd never done anything off Accident of Birth or Chemical Wedding. So we went and learned those songs as well. And then, of course, it became apparent that we needed another guitarist because this was going to be a metal show.
Yeah.
And we'd been doing, funnily enough, me and Alex Dixon and I think Robin Guy as well, we'd been doing Kiss covers with Pete Friesen from The Almighty and Alice Cooper's band. And he was living in London. He happens to be a Kiss fan. So he was playing Kiss covers with us. And we were like, he'd be pretty good. So we called him up, got him involved. So then it was like a mates band again. It's all just good fun. And we've just got to play this heavy metal set, do some Maiden songs, stick Delilah at the end for a bit of fun. And that was just total blast. And, it was one gig per weekend over the summer. You know, you could get as drunk as you wanted and you come home with your hangover and you got 5 days to get over it and then fly out again. And we did like Sweden Rock Festival, Tuska, Wacken. And the crazy thing was, of course, like I was saying, back in the Skunk Works days, playing with Bruce, we're supporting Halloween or we're playing a club. And this, we're headlining Sweden Rock Festival. And the band on before us was a small British group. I don't know if you know a band called Motorhead. And they're on before us.
Right.
And I remember me and Robin, the drummer, on the side of stage watching Motorhead, you know, Lemmy and Mickey D and that. Like, okay, so you're the next drummer going on and I'm the next bass player going on. We're going to follow Lemmy and Mickey D, are we? Yeah. That's going to work, is it? You know. And then the same fucking headlined the Saturday night.
Right.
And we did an amazing gig in Greece. And we just did a few of those over the summer. And it was just hilarious fun, you know. And actually, I think those were the last solo shows that Bruce properly did.
I guess so.
Yeah. Because then he did Tyranny of Souls and there was no tour for it.
All right.
We did some shows in Brazil in 2005. Me and Roy Z.
Oh, okay.
With Bruce. But that was a different thing. That was a guy called Renato Tribuzzi had an album and he had me and Roy and Bruce guesting on it.
Okay.
And then we went over and did some shows in Brazil for his album. And in the encores, we did Tears of the Dragon and a couple of things. But yeah, 2002 and Tuska Festival was the last ever Bruce Dickinson solo shows.
Right. Yeah. I guess there's now the new Bruce album in works, isn't there? At least what I've been a little bit hearing.
There is, apparently, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I think what's been going on is that Roy and Bruce have just been writing casually for years now.
Okay.
I don't think they ever stopped writing, you know, since they first met, maybe. You know, they might have a year off here and there, but they're constantly sending little ideas backwards and forwards. And so I would imagine they've got more than an album's worth finished.
Yeah, I think there was some news that they at least met and doing at least something in the studio.
Roy put up on Facebook that they'd been in the studio and had a drummer there. And so I think that is actually, they've probably been recording demos for the last 10 or 20 years. And this is actually making the album now.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm not, you know, the prophet. I can't see into the future and I'm not involved in the recording of it. But yeah, I would imagine there's a Bruce solo album to come in the next year or so.
And possibly with the Tribe of Gypsies, at least somewhat. Well, of course, if Roy Z is there, at least. But
no, I don't think so.
Uh-huh, okay.
It's a different drummer. I can't remember his name.
Damn, I would have liked to hear David Ingraham again. Drums.
No, I don't think so. David's doing mostly photography these days, I see. Yeah. And they're using a keyboard player from Croatia, I think.
Okay.
There's something about Croatian keyboard players, because there's a Croatian keyboard player in Whitesnake at the moment. And there's another one playing for Bruce.
Uh-huh.
Something about Croatia, something in their Kalarachko beer that just makes you be a great keyboard player.
Yeah, possibly. I guess so. we'll see. It would be interesting to hear, of course.
Absolutely,
Bruce material.
That'll be curious to see what happens.
We will see soon.
Let's hope so.
But hey, thanks for like dropping by with such a quick notice. And
you're very welcome. It's been good. That was really good chat. Good chat, man. And hope people want to buy the silly Inside the Skunk Works machine.
Yes, I bet they will. I will put for sure links to the description.
Yeah, do that.
I will be diving into that thing very soon. Right, so thanks a lot for the chat.
You're very welcome.
Alrighty.